WBUR Boston. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Life is always taxing, but no more so than today. Last year, Congress passed President Bush's 10-year, $1.3 trillion tax cut to ease the burden on the American people and grow the economy. Tonight, we're adding up the cost and benefits of the Bush tax cuts ahead of Thursday's vote in the House of Representatives to make them permanent. We begin in the Middle East, where today Prime Minister Sharon announced Israeli forces will be out of all West Bank cities and towns except Bethlehem and Ramallah by the end of the week, and Israel announced the arrest of a top Arafat aide. Earlier, I spoke with Washington Post correspondent Keith Richburg in Jerusalem and asked about the arrest and its potential fallout.
Marwan Barghouti is one of probably Yasser Arafat's closest lieutenants. He has been in charge of this Palestinian uprising, or intifada, on the West Bank in the town of Ramallah since it began 18 months ago. His official title is he is the head of the Fatah, which is Yasser Arafat's personal political faction in Ramallah, and also the head of the Tanzim, which is the military wing of that faction. More important, although the official titles really don't mean anything on the street, he is young, he's in his 40s, he's popular, and since this uprising started, we would see him at the forefront of these very massive Palestinian funerals for people killed by Israeli troops, always with his machine gun over his shoulder and wearing his leather jacket. He's probably the closest thing in the West Bank to a real popular political figure for the Palestinians, so this arrest will have major implications.
Your colleague at Newsweek, Chris Dickey, reported today, hearing from an Israeli military source, that Barghouti was a, quote, marked man, and that the Israelis had hoped to kill him during their campaign on the West Bank. Why did they want to kill them, and what do they want to do with him now?
Well, there was, we believe, an attempt at assassinating Barghouti. You know, the Israelis have carried out these assassinations, which they call targeted killings, of suspected terrorists in the past. There was a car that was rocketed by a helicopter that blew up some months ago, and Barghouti escaped miraculously unhurt. He was in another car in that motorcade. So he has been marked by a long time. He has been on their list. They called him today. They just told me he was their most wanted. By capturing him now, I think what they would like to do is be able to interrogate him and find real links between Yasser Arafat and some of these suicide bombers. Barghouti was known to be helping finance this group called the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade that's claimed credit for many of these suicide bombings, including just the one the other day here in Jerusalem, which was a young woman bomber. And what they'd love to be able to do is interrogate, question Barghouti, get some details out of him that would link Yasser Arafat to the financing of these groups. The problem is, on the Palestinian street, this arrest by Israel would just only increase Marwan Barghouti's popularity. And I had a senior military person tell me just today that they're really worried that now there could be some attempt to kidnap an Israeli and hold him for hostage or exchange or some kind of terrorist acts.
Well, earlier, people had mentioned Barghouti as a possible successor to Arafat and as, quote, a more moderate leader. What do you think of that assessment? And today, Prime Minister Sharon said, we can't deal with Arafat. He said, I believe there are others we could deal with. Does he mean Barghouti, or who does he mean?
Well, it's a real problem, because given what's been happening over the last 18 months, even the ones considered moderate, quote-unquote, Palestinians have become radicalized. The difference, and it's a subtle distinction, but a very important one, the difference between Marwan Barghouti and some of the other more extreme ones was Barghouti believed in armed struggle against Israel, but only to expel Israel from Palestinian-occupied territories. Barghouti is from Ramallah. He grew up on the West Bank. You know, he's from that part of the territories. That distinguishes him from the Hamas and Islamic Jihad extremists who believed in setting off bombs and suicide attacks inside Israel proper. These are the fellows who believe they want to drive Israel into the sea. If you want to negotiate, you're going to have to negotiate with the people whose only goal is to end the occupation and to have two states next to each other, Palestine and Israel. That really sets him apart from the extremists who believe Israel shouldn't exist.
So could he possibly be someone with whom they could negotiate?
Well, they'd have to let him out of jail.
Yeah.
extremists. Right. And the problem is you've got, you know, the extremists on both sides. You've got people who just so want to tie Barghouti and Arafat in with the terrorists that they're not looking to see that this might be someone they could negotiate with in the future. Ironically, by being arrested now, and assuming he gets out of jail at some point in the future, this will really only increase his stature in Palestinian eyes. And as I said, he's only in his 40s. You know, he's got a long time to go. He can come back and really be a leader, because I've been on the streets. I've seen the kind of really, you know, wild applause Marwan Barghouti would get among young Palestinians. And that's something really Arafat and his security chiefs never could achieve.
As to Arafat, the Jerusalem Post last week reported that in his Knesset speech, Prime Minister Sharon seemed to be making a case for Arafat as a war criminal. Did you hear anything like that?
Well, that's been asked here, and they're definitely making a case trying to tie Arafat directly to terrorist activities, trying to tie him to the deaths of Israelis and suicide bombings. It's a very tenuous link because, I mean, Arafat's been very careful not to make sure that his signature is not traceable on too many things other than the financing, and that's his Achilles heel, which is Arafat always controlled the money of the Palestinian Authority very tightly. But still, you know, he's always going to be able to make the argument that, you know, he didn't know where the money was being spent, and he's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. The Israelis have to be very, very careful because, you know, there is now a judge in Belgium investigating war crimes trial possibilities against Ariel Sharon, and this is going back to the massacre in the camps in Lebanon in the early 1980s during the Israeli invasion. So, you know, these things, you know, accusing each other of war crimes can backfire and boomerang on you. So I think Ariel Sharon would not be in a very good position to accuse Yasser Arafat of war crimes, particularly after what people are saying happened in the Jenin refugee camp.
Which is, in brief?
There are quite a number of Palestinians dead. We don't know how many. The Israelis say over 100. Palestinians say 500. Many of them are going to be unarmed civilians. The Israelis have been bulldozing houses, often with people inside, and they've been preventing ambulances from going around to pick up people. So we've got many, many confirmed stories, as well as some we can't confirm, of people who just bled to death because they could not get picked up into an ambulance. The International Committee of the Red Cross has criticized it. The UN Human Rights Commission, International League for Human Rights, various groups have criticized this practice. So Israel is really on the defensive about what's happened in Jenin.
And their own Supreme Court has intervened in it.
That's right. There was a plan by the Israeli military to bury the bodies of the Jenin dead. They said very, very bluntly that they wanted to do this to prevent the Palestinians from making a propaganda coup out of the number of dead there. The Supreme Court decided, no, you can't just bury Palestinian dead. You have to turn them over to the Palestinian Red Crescent or turn them over to their families. So it's a bit of a blow for the military. And also now that the NGOs and the journalists are starting to get into that Jenin camp, it's becoming uncovered now, the scale of the destruction there.
Keith Richburg is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. On Thursday, the House votes to make last year's tax cut permanent. Everybody wants tax relief, especially today. But what are the long-term consequences of the Bush tax plan? Can the country afford it? And when and how will you feel it? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With us tonight from New York is James Glassman. He is resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and syndicated columnist for the Washington Post. Jim, it's good to have you on the show.
Well, good to talk to you, Jack.
About 20 years ago, you told me, get out of real estate and put all your money into the stock market. I'm not yet clear. I'm not sure that I would have done better or worse. What do you think?
Well, it depends on where you put your money into the real estate. I think Boston's pretty good, but in 20 years, the stock market has gone up by a factor 20, which ain't bad.
Hard to beat that in real estate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jim, let's be pedestrian for a moment. Set up the tax cut, last year's tax cut for us. What was it? What did it involve?
Sure. There were several elements to it, and it totaled about $1.3 trillion over a 10-year period. One of the most dramatic elements was the phasing out and complete elimination of estate taxes, or what Republicans are fond of calling death taxes. There were also cuts in what are called marginal tax rates, that is the rate that you pay on the next dollar of income that you earn, and those were across the board. They affected everyone who pays taxes. And there were a bunch of little odds and ends, like some changes in what's called the marriage penalty. But the two main things were reductions in marginal rates and the phase out of the estate tax. Now, the little tricky thing here is that because of something in the Senate that's called the Byrd Rule, named for Robert Byrd, the dean of the Senate, I guess now, he's been, I think he's now in his sixth or seventh term, this allows the Senate to pass a tax bill even though there's not a super majority, a tax cut bill or a tax increase bill. However, such a bill has to expire within 10 years. So all of these tax cuts, and I think, again, most dramatically the estate tax cut, but all of them, expire in the year that would be 2011. And then in 2012, you would get, or Americans would get, a total tax increase of about $200 to $300 billion, which is pretty big, and I think almost politically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So right now what's happening is the House, which already passed the original tax cut without the Byrd Amendment on it, because that's a Senate amendment, mm-hmm. is now saying, we're going to go ahead and repass this bill and make it permanent. But frankly, it's not going to mean much because the Senate is not going to go along with it. It's just the House, again, saying, hey, look, you know, you can't have a tax cut that phases out in 10 years. Let's do it again. And it's also, I think, to some extent, the Ways and Means Chairman, Bill Thomas, simply cashing in on the fact that this is April 15th. Americans are paying a lot of taxes, and so it's sort of reminding them that this thing ought to be made permanent.
Now, there was an anomaly, or there's several in the bill. One of them involved the alternative minimum tax and the prospect that between now and 2010, many Americans might actually wind up paying more taxes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. This gets a little complicated, but there was a law passed several years ago called the alternative minimum tax, which limits the amount of deductions that you can take, essentially, and that if you take too much in the way of deductions, then your overall average tax bill, that is the percentage of your total income, will go down below a certain level. And there, the alternative minimum tax kicks in. It means that you're going to have to pay more taxes. Now, this was originally a law that was meant to catch rich people who weren't paying much in taxes. But what's happened is that over the years, Americans have moved into higher and higher tax brackets, and it's going to catch lots and lots of average or slightly above average Americans. The alternative minimum tax really needs to be adjusted or phased out, and I think both parties agree with that. The problem is that it's difficult to do, mm-hmm. Because it will cost a lot of money, and so they didn't want to put it in the last tax bill, but it's going to come up. There's no doubt about it.
Briefly, did any of us see this tax cut in this year's tax returns?
Yeah, you did. And actually, one part of the tax cut I forgot because it's not necessarily all that significant for the long term, but it was certainly very important in the short term. Was a tax rebate which kicked in last year and essentially meant that every single taxpayer in America, no matter what your tax bracket, got, I believe it was $300 per individual or $500 per family, somewhere around there. And that was basically a windfall for many Americans. Most economists don't think it's very important, but it actually helped tremendously during the economic slowdown. It put money into people's pockets at a time when the economy was slowing down. And a lot of economists, including my colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, just wrote something about this, John Makin, feel that it was tremendously important in keeping the recession very mild. And in fact, some people believe that we didn't even have a recession. So we've seen that kick in, and then the other thing that we've seen kick in is these reductions in marginal rates. For example, the top rate this year will go from 39.6% to 38.6%. Everyone's going to have a slightly lower marginal tax rate. So we're beginning to see it, and also the the estate tax, the exemption for the estate tax, I believe, went to, I may have the number wrong, $675,000 mm-hmm. up from $600,000, somewhere in there.
We're going to break for a minute, Jim, and be right back with you. We're talking about the costs and benefits of the Bush tax cut. Should Congress make it permanent when it votes later this week? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about the 2001 tax cut this hour. Here's President Bush speaking earlier today in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
If you let people keep their own money, they tend to want to spend it. And when they spend it, they're going to buy a good or a service. And somebody will provide the good or a service. And when they provide or produce the good and service, it means somebody's going to find work. The best way to make sure that workers continue to work in the face of a recession is to cut the taxes on the people who do the work in America, and that's what we did.
That was President Bush speaking earlier today in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, ahead of Thursday's vote in the House of Representatives to make the 2001 tax cuts permanent. We're talking with James Glassman of the American Enterprise Institute about the tax cut. Jim, make the case for making the tax cut permanent for us.
Well, I think it's very important for both individuals and businesses to have something solid to go on in the future. People have to make decisions about, for example, their estate planning. I mean, it's unfortunate, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I wish we didn't have to do any estate planning in this country, but it has to be done. You know, how to make out your will. I mean, people really need some certainty for that. And it's true as well with investing and really with even with making decisions about your job, what kind of job you're going to take, where you're going to go. You need to know what the tax rates are. And unfortunately, we have this incredibly complicated tax system, so that the least that we can ask for at this point is some kind of certainty or near certainty about what the rates are going to be, you know, what deductions are going to be allowed and so forth, so people can make those decisions.
And especially this would be the case with the estate tax, which essentially mean if you died on December 31, 2009, you could leave all your money to your children, but if you died the next day, you'd be out of luck.
It's really incredible. I mean, you know, theoretically, you could see a lot of suicides in that final year. I mean, I don't think this is going to happen, but it just shows you the absurdity of the tax cut. I have to say that, the phasing out of the estate tax is not the most important thing on my own tax cut agenda. I really think that what's best for the economy and best for individual Americans would be to reduce marginal rates, reduce the tax rates that people pay. I don't have a huge objection to the estate tax, but remarkably enough, what surveys show is that the estate tax at all levels of income, mm-hmm. this is true of poor Americans as well as middle-income Americans, rich Americans, is a really a hated tax. And people feel like, well, you know, you earn the money, you pay the taxes, you should be able to pass it on to your children or your church or wherever you want to do it. And it's not a very well-liked tax.
Even though very few Americans ever have to pay.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It's a
2%
tiny percentage. The last time I looked at these figures, and they may be higher now, only 25,000 returns a year out of about 1 million people who die a year pay any estate tax at all. Now, part of the reason for that is because of estate planning. People set up trusts. You know, mm-hmm. they have ways to move money around. So mm-hmm. so it's a little distorted, but it's still a very tiny number.
Yeah. What are the long-term consequences of the Bush tax plan? Can we afford it? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Robert McIntyre, president of Citizens for Tax Justice. Bob, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm just fine. Bob, Jim Glassman just made a case for the making the tax cut of 2001 permanent. Before we get to that, though, you have software that I believe is all but unrivaled that sort of maps the distribution effects of tax cuts. That is to say, who gets what. Score the 2001 tax cut for us. Who got what?
Well, overall, I mean, if you take the whole thing, about just under 40% of it went to the best off 1% of the population. The rest of it went to the other 99%, but hardly any of that went to the bottom two-thirds. So it was pretty well targeted to, you know, you could call it Republican campaign contributors or people that George Bush knows personally or whatever you think, but very targeted to the high end of the income scale. But moving on to your real topic.
Yeah.
The interesting question. You remember last year when President Bush and the Republicans in Congress sold this to the members of Congress and the public. They said, look, we can have a big tax cut. We can pay down the national debt. We can protect Social mm-hmm. Security. We can spend more money. And then that turned out not to be true. They're going to have run deficits outside of Social Security for as far as they can see. That's what they now tell us. And so it's kind of interesting that they now say, well, the only answer, our tax cut, we just have to make it permanent now. Just kind of funny, you know?
And the rationale has slipped, too, hasn't it?
Well, the rationale was that we had all this extra money. Give the people back the excess. That was the best argument the president made. Turns out we don't have any excess anymore. And you know, when they designed this, they phased it in very slowly to try to squeeze this $2 trillion tax cut into $1.3 trillion over 10 years. And now they're saying, hey, you know, we can afford another $4 trillion over the next 10, because that's what it will cost fully in place for the next 10 years after that. Very scary. I mean, I guess they just don't care about debt, but some of us do.
Mm. Jim Glassman, do you care about debt?
Yeah, but we don't have very much of it. And compared to any other country in the world, we have a very, very low levels of debt. We don't pay very much as far as our the interest on our debt. And let's not forget something else. The Congressional Budget Office's latest report, which came out in January, shows that over the next 10 years, the total surplus, and I'm reading it right now, will be $2.26 trillion. Now, understandably, you know, these projections can be wrong. They get changed every year. But we are not talking about some kind of runaway deficit.
Well, we are.
Let me add one thing before we get a little off on the wrong tangent here. The reason for these changes that have come about in the projections is not in any significant degree the tax cuts at all. It is increased spending, and Glenn Kessler has an excellent piece today in the Washington Post that shows that spending on government programs will increase by 22% from 99 to 03 in inflation-adjusted dollars. This is the biggest increase in two decades. So there is runaway spending. There's not runaway tax cutting.
Bob McIntyre?
Well, that's just not true. We have the big defense increases. We hope they're temporary and this gets over, but domestic spending is not going up. In fact, by most measures, it's going down. But the tax cuts, which is what we started off talking about, are a huge piece of this this problem, and the fact that we're not going to have $2 trillion in surpluses. We're having deficits as far as we can see. The surpluses Jim's talking about are borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund, and the hope was a few years ago that if we paid down the national debt, we'd have enough money to pay Social Security benefits in the future. The president promised he'd do that, and he didn't, and that seems to me a change of reality that he's unwilling to face up to.
Mm. What about the stimulative effect, though, of this?
Hey, the short term was good, Jack. You're right. The Democrat part of that program, those rebates, excellent idea. The president fought it tooth and nail, and they only got it in at the last minute as a compromise to do something to stimulate things because people were worried about the economy slowing, mm-hmm. and they want to do something for the lower income people. But yeah, he fought that, and now he's taking credit for it. In fact, that's all he talked about today in Cedar Rapids was how he gave something to these poor middle class people here, and didn't talk at all about the upper income tax cuts. Didn't talk about the fact that 3 weeks ago they just repealed a fifth of the corporate income tax. That wasn't on his agenda to talk about. And you know why? It's really unpopular when the public finds out that whether it's Enron or anybody else, that these big companies or rich people aren't paying taxes, they get incensed. And right now we're looking at a situation where almost half the income taxes that people pay are going to pay for corporate tax breaks and interest in the national debt. And that's really lousy. You know, you don't mind paying your taxes if you're getting something for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if all you're getting for it is pay down, you know, interest on the debt and tax breaks for big business, I mean, that has to make people annoyed. It annoys me anyway.
Right. Let's take a call from Herb. Herb, hello.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about the inheritance tax. It's my understanding that the inheritance tax changes mean that the basis of your tax from when you bought it is what the heir has to pay taxes on, rather than the basis on your date of death. And effectively, that means someone with a small estate, his or her heirs, have to pay essentially a death tax that they didn't have to pay before if they left less than $1 million.
Well, that's a rumor, but it's not true. The way they structured it, if it ever takes effect in 2010, there'd still be an exemption from the carryover basis, so-called, for states below the old limits on how much was taxed. So nobody loses.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, all the taxpayers who have to make up the $50 billion a year in lost revenue, I don't want to leave them out.
Right. Jim Glassman makes the case that making the tax cut permanent would actually have help grow the economy, because it would create some stability, whereas the strange event that these tax cuts may stop in 10 years, that will sort of inhibit investment decisions. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure I get it. You don't believe them when they say they're going to be sunsetted, but you're not quite sure. But you would believe them if they say they're going to be permanent. Why would you be any sure?
Well, the
country's going to be broke in 10 years.
And
there's a really good chance we're going to have to raise taxes, including rolling back some of this stuff. So I don't know why you trust them any more this year than last year.
Mm-hmm. Jim Glassman?
Yeah, just a few things. First of all, I'm not sure why Bob says that spending has not gone up as a percentage of GDP. So let me just refer all of him, as well as all of your listeners, to Glenn Kessler's excellent, he's a reporter, not an opinionator like I am, excellent piece in today's Washington Post on page A1. I'll just read one quote. Measured another way, federal spending minus interest costs on the debt will have grown by nearly 2 percentage points of the overall U.S. economy from 1999 to 2003. That is a big number. And by the way, last year we had the highest percentage of taxes as a percent of GDP going to the federal government that we've had since World War II. So I think by many measures, taxes are quite high at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing that Bob always trots out, and I think it's important for people to understand this, the reason that when you do an across-the-board tax cut, even one that slightly favors lower-income people, as the Bush tax cut did, that you end up giving large cuts to people who make a lot of income is that those are the people who pay the income taxes. The top 1% of earners pays about 25% of all income taxes. The bottom 50% of earners pays about 1 or 2% of all income taxes. So it's almost impossible to do an across-the-board tax cut in which people who at the upper end of the income mm-hmm. scale who
don't,
pay the most taxes
don't
end up with the most tax cuts. It's a very simple mathematical situation.
Yeah.
Well, they did better than that, of course. They gave almost 40% of the cuts to the top 1%. So it was very disproportionate in their favor, even if you did it as a share of their current taxes.
Right, and people who didn't pay income tax got nothing, right?
Right, but they do pay Social Security taxes. They pay gasoline taxes. They pay lots of taxes.
Right. Steve is on the line. Hello. Steve?
Hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Welcome.
Okay, good. Listen, I had a question. Jim was remarking that, unfortunately, we have a terribly complex tax code, and he said that as he was trying to explain what some of the effects might be of a tax cut. But why not make it simpler? I mean, it is so complex that there are very few people who really claim to know it in its entirety. If there are any, I imagine they're probably also smoking something. So I mean, I'm remembering what Paul Samuelson said in his Newsweek article about, here I am, a PhD in economics, and I can't even figure it out.
Can't fill out his tax returns or figure out the tax code. Were you intimating, Steve, a flat tax? Is that what you had in mind?
No, not necessarily. You see, what I'm thinking is overall simplification is a key here, because you're talking about reliability of being able to predict what's going to happen in the future. When it's so complex, you don't know. I mean, I remember years ago when we could deduct interest payments on credit cards. So here I have all this debt. All of a sudden, all that's taken out, you know? So obviously, from a planning perspective, I had a big problem there.
Yeah. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. Jim, tax simplification, is that in the works?
Look, Jimmy Carter called the tax code a disgrace to the human race, and he was talking about the importance of simplification back, I don't know, wasn't that 25 years ago? It's really a shame that the Bush administration, which understands how important simplification is not doing it. But we can actually look to the Russians, of all people.
The Russians
instituted a 13% flat tax last year. Revenues soared. It's very interesting. They're also instituting a flat corporate tax soon, and it's not a bad idea. There's very little we can learn from the Russians in an economic sense, mm-hmm. but this is one of them.
What do you think about that, Bob McIntyre? Flat tax? You're in favor of tax simplification.
I'm absolutely in favor of simplification, yeah. and I can back it up with actually being in favor of it, as opposed to, say, the Bush administration or others who talk a good line on Tuesdays and Thursdays and Mondays and Wednesdays, propose new tax breaks for this, that, and everything else, which is, of course, what makes it complicated. Mm-hmm. Lessons from the Russians is a little weird. On the other hand, you know, we did have a major tax simplification, real serious stuff in 1986, and the leadership, the Republican leadership in Congress all voted against it back then, and now they are dismantling that. So, you know, you need new leadership. I don't know if the current Democrats are the right people either, because most of them don't have much interest either. But if you want tax simplification, I don't know how high it is on people's agenda, it's high on mine, you got to elect some people who actually mean it. You know, the Bush administration released a tax simplification plan today.
Mm-hmm.
Just a minor piece, one thing that's kind of complicated, how you define a child for tax purposes. And by the time they got done with their proposal, they'd made it twice as complicated as it is now. So they had great rhetoric. It's awful. It's too complicated, and then they propose to make it more complicated.
Of course, the rub there, isn't it, Bob, is you have to give up deductions to simplify the tax code.
Well, most of the complication until recently was all in business taxes, which is fertile ground for simplification. But under Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress, we've got the IRS running the education programs and the health programs and a whole bunch of things they shouldn't be running. Get them back to collecting the taxes from the people that ought to be paying them. And if you want to have education benefits, put it in a department where the rest of us don't have to deal with it except when our kids are in college.
Mm. Jim Glassman, briefly, what about that? As I recall, it was the Bradley bill in the late 80s that simplified taxes. We've gotten away from that, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is an area where Bob and I are in complete agreement, and we really need a simpler system. Just to go back to the Russians again, they are instituting for small businesses a choice between a tax on revenues, I think it's 8%, or a tax on income, that is mm-hmm. to say profits, of 26%. I think that's not a bad idea, rather than having all these complicated definitions of what's an expense and what's not an expense.
Hey, Jim, don't ever propose something like that. Then they're going to fill it out twice to decide which one they like better.
The worst of all worlds. It would be a lot quicker than it is right now.
Anything would be quicker than what we have right now. Bob, I got to say goodnight to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and good to talk to you, Jim.
Okay.
That was Robert McIntyre, President of Citizens for Tax Justice. We're talking about the Bush tax plan. Do you think it needs to be made permanent? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about this week's vote on whether the Bush tax plan of 2001 should be made permanent. Our guest is James Glassman of the American Enterprise Institute. And you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're fine.
Here's my comment, is right now we're in a unique situation where generally most of the baby boomers and a good portion of their children are all buying into the tax base. Most of the baby boomers, of course, are going to be retiring in the next 5 or 10 years, leaving only one generation of people to therefore make up the slack. Isn't this the time when we should be seeing the most surplus ever in this country? Isn't this the time when we should be bankrolling this all for a time when there's a whole bunch of people not working anymore?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Excuse me. And it's one that, excuse me, some Democrats made against the plan last year. Jim Glassman?
Yeah, there's no doubt that there are demographic shifts going on in America, but we shouldn't really exaggerate them. Those of us who are baby boomers have always believed that we were the center of the universe. Jack and I certainly have always felt that way. But the truth is that the generation between the ages of 0 and 20 is actually bigger than the baby boomer generation. The generation X is almost as big as the baby boomer generation. So this is not a huge problem. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has some very good projections going out at least for the next 10 years. We could get into trouble 30 and 40 years from now, but my gosh, I mean, it's very hard to tell what demographics are going to be like then. There could be a lot more immigration than there is today, and I just don't think that that is a major problem that's facing America right now.
Kevin, what's your reaction to that?
The 0 to 20 being a large group of people, is that I understand that. My point is that the Generation X is all working. I mean, there's a lot of them, and mm-hmm. they're all working. There's baby boomers, which I believe is the largest, other than probably the 0 to 20s. I mean, it's a huge number of people that are going to be retiring in 10 years. Doesn't leave us with
There is that ratio, Jim, isn't there, of, you know, two.
The ratio is changing, and mm-hmm. there certainly are problems as far as the funding of Social Security is concerned, and there's no mm-hmm. doubt about that, and I think that all policymakers have been looking into that, and there are different ways to solve that problem. One is to personalize accounts or privatize accounts. Another is to raise taxes or to cut or to increase the year at which you can retire and so forth. But it is not a major tax problem. I'm just actually looking at the Congressional Budget Office figures. So 10 years from now, the projections are, and these come from the best economists. This is not political stuff, but from the best economists, total revenues will be $3.3 trillion in 2011 as opposed to $1.9 trillion this year. So it's not like we're not going to have a lot of money. Now, we may be spending it. Mm-hmm. We may be spending it like crazy, which I think is the biggest problem right now. Mm-hmm. But there will be money coming in.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, thank you. Dennis is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I think Mr. Glassman made a comment earlier, and I don't want to take us off topic. You can tell me if it is, but he made a comment about the national debt, and the topic of the program is about whether we can afford the tax plan. I used to work in Manhattan, and I used to walk up and down 42nd Street, and there used to be a sign, I don't know if it's still there, that with the national debt clock, mm-hmm. and the numbers moved so fast you couldn't even see them. And I don't understand why, from a personal perspective, it's good for me as a person to pay down my debt to avoid high interest payments. I don't understand why in surplus times it's not a good idea, or the government isn't good about paying down our debt, especially when I understand that debt service is one of the top three budget items for the government.
Indeed it is. Jim Glassman, how about that? I mean, it's kind of the moral gravamen of tax cuts, that you basically leave a lot of this onto the children of the future. Paying for it, that is.
Right. Well, let's just look at the numbers, and I think it is important. It's true that interest was a huge percentage of the actual spending that this country has been doing, government spending. It's gone down considerably. It's this year it's expected to be $170 billion. Let's not also forget that money goes from some Americans to other Americans. It's essentially a transfer payment to people who own bonds. But more important is, what is the percentage of debt as a percentage of GDP, that is, mm-hmm. say, our total output.
Right.
So last year it was 33%, and according to the latest projections, which include the increased spending and the tax cuts, by 2011 it will go down to 15%.
30%. Even at 33%, I was just in Japan, which is having problems. There's no doubt about that.
Sure.
But the Japanese debt is 130% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the rest of the world, we actually have a fairly low percentage of debt, and indeed we are paying it down. That is that's where the surplus goes.
Yeah.
Now, this next year we're not going to have a surplus, so we won't be able to pay it down, but
right.
we will be having a surplus in the years next 4 or 5 years.
But your premise there is growth, and here I have a Brookings Institution study, a 90-page study summarized. It's just published in March. The author said, our central conclusions is that the tax cut will reduce the size of the future economy, raise interest rates, and make taxes more regressive and prove fiscally unsustainable. What about that? That by raising long-term interest rates, the positive growth effects of the tax cut will be outweighed by the contractionary effects.
Well, Jack, there's something that that I call the Rubin fallacy, and I'm not the only one who calls it that, which is the notion that in a country where you have a deficit, that is to say, the government is spending more money than it's taking in by a small degree, which is what we may have the next few years, that deficit can boost interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
There is no academic research, zero, that shows that that's true. And we can see it in action by looking, for example, during the Reagan years, interest rates dropped as the deficit rose. During the Clinton years, we had a decline in the deficit. It turned into a surplus, and yet interest rates did not take a nosedive at all. In fact, they were level. We've seen this in Japan and the United States. In the United States, we've gone from a deficit to a surplus. In Japan, they've gone to an astronomical deficit, and yet in both countries, interest rates have been just about level. So there is not this link that many people think that there is, unless you got runaway deficits.
Mm-hmm.
There is not that link.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for it, which is that government debt is actually a very tiny percentage of total debt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've had a test of the opposite proposition, that by reducing the budget deficit, you can lower interest rates, and that can produce growth itself. That is to say, even by raising taxes, insofar as that cuts the deficit, you can get a growth effect.
We just
had a test of that in the Clinton years.
It depends on how much you raise taxes. During the Clinton years, I know a lot of my colleagues on the right, yelled and screamed at the tax increase of 1993. It was not a significant tax increase at all. And the reason that revenues flowed into the federal coffers, and there were fabulous revenues, I mean, we were increasing revenues by 7 or 8% a year,
mm-hmm.
unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
The reason was that the economy turned around, and there are lots of different reasons for that. And I give credit to the Clinton administration, although I think that's only one small area where they were able to hold down some of the spending and had really, I think, very good fiscal policies.
And Al Gore had invented the internet, too. That helped.
Oh, I think more than anything.
Royce is on the line. Hello, Royce.
Hi. Not many of those in the chattering classes are actually in that top 1% that's realizing the biggest benefit from the tax cuts. But very few of us are in the 15% bracket where, if I have my figures right, something more than 40% of the American taxpayers sit. And one thing that I never hear mentioned is that these supposedly across-the-board tax cuts are not across the board. The 15% marginal rate is not reduced at all. And I think I would propose that maybe the way to deal with all this is say, let's go ahead and keep all of the tax breaks in the Bush tax cuts that are making life better for those on making up to a median income.
Mm-hmm.
And, the rich, after the end of the 10 years, will keep their same size cut as all the rest of us get. But the interesting thing about that proposition is that for 40% of Americans, it will make no difference at all,
mm-hmm.
because they're not getting anything from this at all except that $300 rebate.
Right.
And they're not going to get any more next year
right.
when taxes go down. They're not going to get any more the year after that when taxes go down again and so forth.
Jim, Royce raises the question of politically tinkering with this measure. What do you think? Any prospect of that?
Well, I would just want to correct Royce, and yeah. I'm actually frantically looking at the bill here to try to find exactly the number. But the 15% bracket is going down. There's no doubt about that. In fact, I think it goes down.
It goes down to 10%.
Right,
I have it here.
It goes down to 10%, and that's a 33% cut in the rate. So it's not like the 15% bracket is not declining. The people who aren't getting something out of this...
Right, that's what Royce was mentioning.
Are the people who don't pay taxes at all. Mm-hmm. Those are the people who are
don't pay income taxes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People who do pay Social Security taxes, and that's something I would love to see corrected, because that's a huge chunk out of low-income people's income is effectively the 15% of their income that's taken away through payroll taxes.
On this question, thank you, Royce. On this question of the tax cuts, Senator Kennedy, as you know, said, well, maybe we should postpone them for the upper brackets until the fiscal situation is righted. He hasn't had much company in that, has he?
No, and he's not, and I don't think he's going to. I think that once you have a tax cut, it is very hard to take it away, both for the reasons I was talking about before, that people plan on it, they expect it, and because when you take away a tax cut, it is a tax increase. I mean, there's no way around it. And, maybe it shouldn't have happened in the first place, some people say. I disagree. But the idea of taking it back means a rate hike, and that, I think that would be very difficult to achieve.
A tough sell. Jim Glassman, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Jack.
Okay. James Glassman is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, the Prince of Jordan weighs in on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. El Hassan of Jordan spoke last week at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. He gave his unique perspective on the conflict raging just over the border in Israel and said that international institutions must play a major role in creating peace. Here are two brief excerpts from his wide-ranging speech.
When defining the Israeli-Palestinian conflict today, what are the images that spring to mind? Surely they are the harrowing picture of ordinary lives being snuffed out and rent apart by a vicious cycle of violence and revenge that is fueled as much internally by the fight for the control of land as it is externally by international strategic interests. How many times have we watched such footage with furious inadequacy? And how many times have we witnessed human beings becoming cannon fodder to malignant designs? At one time or another, we have all squirmed with the prophets as the land where God chose to reveal his divine will has turned into one blazing killing field. In the last few weeks, the grim toll has mounted on both sides every single day, with new outrages and fresh fatalities. My late brother, His Majesty King Hussein, said that it is vital that terrorism is tackled at the international level. The murder and torture of innocent people is not exclusive to one race or nation or to followers of any one religion. It is vital, therefore, that terrorism is tackled in a multilateral way and not in a gung-ho partisan manner. We have to establish an international mechanism of cooperation and understanding. But I'd like to go back to Afghanistan in the 13th century, to Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, and I'll let you judge whether this is a civilized statement or not. Come now, whoever you are, come without fear of being disliked. Come whether you are a Muslim, a Christian, or a Jew. Come, whoever you are. Come if you believe or you do not believe in God. Come also if you believe in the Son as God. This door is not a door of fear. This is a door of good wishes.
That was Prince El Hassan of Jordan speaking last week at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.